we must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
Let me assert my firm belief that the only thing we have to fear is fear itself.
And we are, as a people, inherently and historically opposed to secret societies, to secret oaths, and to secret proceedings.
An inside job? How dare you? How dare you?
We're all the same. I'll show you politics in America. Here it is, right here. I think the puppet on the right shares my beliefs. I think the puppet on the left is more than unlikely. Hey, wait a minute. There's one guy holding up both puppets. Shut up.
Go back to bed, America. Your government is in control.
Is everybody in? Is everybody in? Is everybody in? The ceremony is about to begin.
Hitting news. Alternative Talk Radio. Get ready, America, for Deadline Live with your host, Jack Blood. Deadline Live is the daily wrap-up for those too busy in the daily grind to discern and dissect the news. While the so-called mainstream media buries the truth, Jack Blood uncovers it, exposing the lies that our trusted government officials do not want us to know. And now, please welcome Jack Blood.
Exposing the lies, the disinformation, the war propaganda, and the social engineering that your trusted government officials do not want you to know about. Welcome to this live original edition of Deadline Live. It is Wednesday, February 3rd, 2010. I'm Jack Blood, your narrator, your radio gun, reporting for the next 2 hours. Had a lot to catch up on today, folks. Wasn't sure I was going to do a show, and then it just came to me. Sometimes that happens. Yesterday, we lost one of the greatest historians, one of the greatest researchers, one of the greatest Americans and citizens of this country or the world. Eustace Mullins passed away yesterday, and he had a stroke a couple of weeks ago. He has just really had a hard time this last couple of years. He was getting really on in years, and while I'm sure there was a conspiracy theory in this, hard to believe that if the New World Order wanted to take him out or could take him out, they would have done that much, much sooner. Eustace Mullins is the father of what we call today the anti-Federal Reserve movement. To be more correct, Ezra Pound, the great poet and scholar, he was the author, and Eustace was the messenger. Now, these last 60 years, his great book, a standard, a must-read, if you can get your hands on it. I have an autographed copy, The Secrets of the Federal Reserve. So what I want to do today, to start off the program with, is a tribute to the great Eustace Mullins. If you're not familiar with him, you are going to learn a lot here in this first hour. It's going to be chock full of information you're not supposed to know about. And we'll also be taking your calls during the program. If you want to remember Eustace, if you met him, or if you've read many of his vast works, if you understand what a great inspiration he's been to the modern, say, modern Tea Party movement, if you like the modern movement, Ron Paul Revolution-style movement that we have today, you can look no further than Eustace Mullins, who inspired just about everybody to pick up this mantle and to continue to rail against central banks, not just in this country, but all around the world. And that is a major component of our program, so we must honor Eustace Mullins today. I've done several interviews with him over the years, and had a good opportunity to get to know him a little bit, and unfortunately, all of those interviews are gone. I don't know if we'll ever get our hands back on those again. But to do a tribute to a man who deserves the highest tribute is my honor, and we'll do so after the program. Take your calls and go to breaking news. Stay with us, Deadline Live. I'm Jack Blood.
What's up? Check this out.
The voice of the revolution. American Freedom Radio. American Freedom Radio.
Can you handle the truth? Tune into the Truth Brigade with Christy Chikowski weeknights from 7 to 9 p.m. Central, only on American Freedom Radio.
And during the few moments that we have left, we want to talk right down to earth in a language that everybody here can easily understand.
Revolution, and that is the way it should be. Thank you for joining us, folks. AmericanFreedomRadio.com, and thank you again, all of our great affiliates picking up the program, whether you're on the internet or out there in terrestrial radio. However you're picking up this show, you have come to the right place. I am Jack Blood, your narrator, your radio gun. As always, it is February 3rd, 2010, if you're just joining us. We're going to get to the news here in a little bit. Iran playing chicken again. playing their role, folks. Nothing much changes in that respect. China continues to fume, threatens war games against the United States of America and her allies. Aid is still not getting to Haiti. The IRS is stocking up on shotguns. And I've got a nice little clip. Ron Paul on Obama's assassination teams. The assassination of American suspected terrorists and enemy combatants. And yesterday there was a standoff, a public shooting in Illinois. I believe I had that in the public shooting pool. Care to get? I'm going back to Cali for the next one. The next public shooting will be in California. Anybody want to? Get in on that pool. I don't mean to make light of these situations, but it is almost unbearable to see these public shootings on a regular basis. And, of course, the end game here, the ultimate conditioning weapon by the gun grabbers, is to demonize our weaponry, what we need to defend ourselves against people like the Federal Reserve, international bankers, and an out-of-control de facto government. Yesterday, while we were doing our program and talking about what I felt were, you know, very important news stories of the day, we've lost a great American in the form of Eustace Mullins. He died yesterday. He'd had a stroke. He would have been 87 years old in March. 3 weeks ago, he did have a stroke in Columbus, Ohio, allegedly. He'd been on an extended tour of his admirers for much of the past year, visiting and chatting with many of the thousands of fans who jumped at the chance to buy his books from him in person. Sometimes you look at that and you say, a little bit too late. I know he had a garage full of those a few years ago, could barely give them away. Unbelievable, really, folks. He is the father of what we know now as the End the Fed movement, exposing the Federal Reserve and their masters. He is the author of such incendiary books as Secrets of the Federal Reserve, Murder by Injection, very timely today, The Curse of Canaan. Mullins was harassed by the FBI for almost half a century and had one of his books burned in Germany in the 1950s. These stories are recounted in one of his books, A Writ for Martyrs, and he was certainly a martyr. Eustace was still a young scholar when he secured a visit with the historic poet Ezra Pound. Pound was committed to a D.C. area mental institution for denouncing the Fed and its owners. Using Mullins as his proxy, Pound managed to speak to us in every subsequent generation enslaved by the world's central banks. Today, it's almost a trend to expose the Federal Reserve. It's almost like a fad. I was hoping that would happen, but it would never have happened without people like Eustace Mullins. He was persecuted so that we could openly speak out as we do today. As I mentioned, they could have killed him at any time, obviously. But they chose instead to make him live through a hell of political correctness, denouncing him because, of course, many of the culprits involved come from a Jewish descent. Not to say that all Jews are bad or all Jews are involved in taking over the world. Merely, I guess, by coincidence, the top controllers come from a Jewish background. But, you know, I believe, and maybe Eustace and I might disagree on that, maybe you and I might disagree on that, but I believe these people were put in place so that we can, and of course the Holocaust and everything else that goes with it, so that we cannot criticize these people, because of course, as we know now, thanks to hate crime speech and these new forms of political correctness being legislated currently, we're not allowed to speak out against anyone who is Jewish. How appropriate to put these people in as your ultimate frontmen, your matrix moles. Now, these people, these New World Order, these New World Order families, these matrix mole, or sorry, neo-pharaoh families, have no commitment to race or religion or even a political paradigm. To them, it is all about control, and controlling money and debt, not just in this country but around the world, is the best and most simple way to do that. Eustace Mullins is a veteran of the United States Air Force. He had 38 months of active service during World War II. He was a native Virginian. He was educated at Washington and Lee University, New York University, Ohio University, University of North Dakota, and also in San Adelende in Mexico, in the Institute for Contemporary Arts in Washington, D.C. The original book I hold in my hand, entitled The Secrets of the Federal Reserve, was published under its initial title, Mullins on the Federal Reserve. It was commissioned by the poet Ezra Pound in 1948. Ezra Pound was a political prisoner for 13 and a half years at St. Elizabeth's Hospital in Washington, D.C., a federal institution for the insane. His release was accomplished largely through the efforts of Eustace Mullins. You have to understand, at that time, who Ezra Pound was. Some of you who are bibliophiles like me, who are into literature, you'll understand that every major poet in the modern time accredits Ezra Pound as one of their prime inspirations. He was famous during his own lifetime. Not something that comes, is normally something you would see for any poet. Usually, you got to die first. At least you did in those days. So it was very unusual to have somebody as cause celeb as Ezra Pound. And he began denouncing the wars, denouncing the Bolshevik Revolution, denouncing communism, and denouncing the Federal Reserve. And while everybody stood by and watched, he was disappeared into this mental institution for over 13 years, where again, he found a young Eustace Mullins. The research at the Library of Congress was directed and reviewed daily by George Stimson, founder of the National Press Club in Washington, whom the New York Times, in September 28, 1952, called a highly regarded reference source in the Capitol. Government officials, congressmen, and reporters went to him for information on any subject. And if you Google, and I don't have it in front of me, but if you Google George Stimson's statement at the National Press Club back in the 50s, he just came right out and said it. We are owned. We are, in the media, and you know it, prostitutes for the New World Order. We can't write what we want to write. Everything we write has to go through an editorial board, and they will not let us ever tell the truth. We are intellectual prostitutes, I believe is what Stimson said. That, to quote, easy to find on the internet. Published in 1952 by Casper and Horton, New York, the original book was the first nationally circulated revelation of the secret meetings of the international bankers at Jekyll Island, Georgia, 1907 to 1910, at which place the draft for the Federal Reserve Act of 1913 was written. During the intervening years, the author continued to gather new and more startling information about the backgrounds of the people who direct the Federal Reserve policies. Up until this time, nobody even knew who these people were. Most people, even as they do today, believed that the Federal Reserve was federal and had actual reserves. Eustace exposed that and the very names and the people behind that for the first time. We owe him a debt of gratitude. New information gathered over the years from hundreds of newspapers, periodicals, and books give corroborating insight into the connections of the international banking houses. While researching this material, Eustace Mullins was on the staff at the Library of Congress. Mullins later was a consultant on highway finance for the American Petroleum Institute, consultant on hotel development for Institutions Magazine, and editor and director of the Chicago Motor Club's four publications. A very accomplished man, a very important man. I want to take you back here through time. I believe this is from the 1980s. Here is Eustace Mullins, in his own words, talking about the New World Order on the Bobby Lee Show, The Mouth of the South. This is roughly about 25 to almost 30 years old, folks, but I'll play it for you today. Please enjoy it.
Hello, I'm Bobby Lee, and this is The Bobby Lee Show. Today we have with us Eustace Mullins, a lecturer, an author of many books, a scholar, Washington and Lee University. And today we're going to be talking about several different subjects. But this particular subject is the most important for today's political venue. And Eustace has written a book called The World Order. Now, Mr. Mullins has been working for the last 50 years to research important questions that need to be answered in relationship of Middle America to the political evolution. Eustace, tell us a little bit, if you would, how you got started in being an author.
Well, I had always intended to be an author, but I had intended to write novels, perhaps some poems, and I had absolutely no interest in any research or any nonfiction work. I didn't consider that as creative writing. So I met a poet, a very bohemian person named Ezra Pound, who was then incarcerated without trial on a more or less lifetime basis, and he asked me to look into the banking interest, the Federal Reserve System, at the Library of Congress there in Washington, D.C., and I did this, and I found it to be quite an interesting story, which launched me on research which continues to the present day.
Now, this book, The New World Order, how does the New World Order deal with the banking interest in America and across the world?
Well, you see, in studying the banking system in the United States, I found it was part of an international system of banking called central banks in Europe, and that the Federal Reserve System, which we had here, was simply an American version of the central banks they had in Europe. And I also found that these banks did not exist as some entity in some world of their own. They were an integral part of what I came to call the world order.
Now, Eustace, this new world order and this banking system, I was under the impression that the banks themselves were American banks and it was the federal government that owned the banks. Are you telling me that our government itself doesn't own these banks?
Well, our government doesn't own anything. We really don't have a government. We're just a colony of England.
How can you say that, a colony of England? Why, I know that they have the Republican Party and the Democrat parties, and I go down to the local bank and I can cash a dollar bill, can't I?
Oh, well, you can go into any colony of Great Britain and cash a check. That doesn't mean you're in an independent nation.
Would you trace for me the colony of Great Britain to the United States and the banks? If I put a Federal Reserve note in the bank today, how can I say or how could you tell me that's a part of a colony of Great Britain?
Well, you see, we started out as a colony of Great Britain, and then presumably we won political independence in the American Revolution. But you see, the American Revolution was not against the bank. The American Revolution was against King George III. So we won against King George III, but we didn't win against the Bank of England, of which King George III was a major stockholder. So King George lost this wonderful colony over here, but he retained the banking control and continued to get his interest and his profits from his American colony, just as before.
Okay, let's go from King George to the Federal Reserve. What happened in between? Because there was some time in there, and some people say that Andrew Jackson was one of the best presidents this country ever had. Could you tell us about him, and what did he do in regard to banking?
Well, you see, immediately after the Revolution, when we had our wonderful independence and we could have the 4th of July and shoot off firecrackers and still pay interest to the Bank of England, which no one seemed to mind because they didn't know about it, and so Andrew Hamilton established or reestablish the Bank of England presence in the United States of America immediately after the Revolution, called the First Bank of the United States, which Jefferson strongly opposed. And when Jefferson became president, he refused to renew the charter of his foreign central bank, the First Bank of the United States, so it went out of existence. And in revenge for that, England declared war on us, and we had the War of 1812, which was simply a banking war. Of course, you won't read that in any history book in England or in the United States. They tell you that American seamen were being impressed by the British Navy. They would stop American ships and impress American seamen. And this was the occasion of the war. Well, that had nothing to do with it. It was simply the Bank of England said, we're going to punish the United States for refusing to renew the charter of the First Bank of the United States. So anyway, the First Bank of the United States disappeared, and then Nicholas Biddle, an agent of James Rothschild of Paris, chartered a second bank of the United States. And it was doing quite well until Andrew Jackson came along, and he said to the bankers, you are a nest of vipers, and by God, I will rout you out. And so he did. He removed all of the government deposits from the Second Bank of the United States in 1836, which caused it to collapse. And in revenge, the Bank of England suspended all American paper, which caused the first great depression in the United States, called the Panic of 1837. That was strictly a banker's panic. And of course, then the Rothschilds came in and bought up American securities at 1 cent on the dollar, and established a great many of the great American fortunes, including J.P. Morgan.
But Andrew Jackson himself, you would credit him with at least taking a stand against this banking monopoly that is destroying his America.
Well, he was a general and a patriot and an American, and to him, the bankers were Satan incarnate. They were robbing and looting this country. They were oppressing the people. They were causing financial depression and widespread suffering. And he said, I'm going to go after them. And he did. Unfortunately, the history books do not tell you why he did anything that he did. So the American children go to school and have no idea what all this was about. Neither do the college students. Neither do the graduate college students.
You know, I saw a beautiful statue of Andrew Jackson not long ago up in Jacksonville, Florida. And a lot of people don't realize that the state of Florida, the first governor was Andrew Jackson.
Yes, that's right.
And this city of Jacksonville was named after this wonderful patriot and hero of the American middle class. Now, let's go a little bit further. You mentioned the word Rothschilds. Where did that name come from, please?
Well, there was a family of moneylenders in Frankfurt, Germany named Bauer, which means peasant. And why these moneylenders were trying to call themselves peasants, I don't know, because none of them had ever been near a plow in their life. And so they were moneylenders, and they needed some way of advertising their business. And so the founder of this dynasty, the House of Rothschild, put up a red shield above his door so that people who came from various parts of Europe to change money with him could find it.
All right, we're going to continue this. I've got two parts. Eustace Mullins left this world yesterday. We are doing our tribute to him today on Deadline Live. Please stay with us, AmericanFreedomRadio.com. We'll come right back after this.
You're listening to the future of talk. American Freedom Radio. Is American Freedom Radio.
There have been differences between America and Europe. No doubt there will be differences in the future. But the burdens of global citizenship continue to bind us together. A change of leadership in Washington will not lift this burden. In this new century, Americans and Europeans alike will be required to do more, not less. Partnership and cooperation among nations is not a choice. It is the only way.
United we stand, divided we fall. This is more than music. It's a revolution. Oh, suck. Give me liberty and give me death. I'ma fight till I ain't a dang in me left. Oh, suck. Give me liberty and give me death. I'ma fight till I ain't a dang in me left. Oh, suck. Give me liberty and give me death. I'ma fight till I ain't a dang in me left. Oh, suck.
give me liberty or give me death. That is the chant that has existed for hundreds of years in this country, something fading away into memory, being replaced by statements that you just heard there by Cousin Barry Obama, your alleged president, who says there will be no choice but to join the New World Order. Well, Eustace Mullins, again, just an amazing historian, an amazing researcher, has given us so much of his life and his time, deserves to be memorialized, to be honored on our program today, and I appreciate you joining us for that if you're just tuning in. Eustace Mullins, author of, among many books, many works, The Secrets of the Federal Reserve, initially published, I believe, in the 1950s, died yesterday at the age of 86 years old. We're going back, we're flashing back and playing some interviews and letting you hear Eustace Mullins in his own words. We're playing an interview, I believe, from the late 80s, showing you how long all of this has been going on. Now, some of you maybe new to all of this think that the fight against the Federal Reserve started with our good friend G. Edward Griffin, or maybe even the Ron Paul Revolution. Or maybe you think it started with the recent Tea Parties. This has been something that has been exposed now for more than half a century, and we are the inheritors of this trust, to break the trusts, so to speak, and to do that with open eyes, open hearts, is really the challenge here, not to fall into the usual solutions in the Hegelian dialectic. That is, thesis plus antithesis. Antithesis equals synthesis. Okay? They create the problem, they stem the reaction by the media that they own, and they provide the solution to the very problem that they cause. Some of you listening to our show and shows like this for a long time have heard all about the Hegelian dialectic practiced and taught in the major Ivy League universities in this country and major universities around the world. This is what the elite learn to do. And by initiation, they are weeded out so that only the players, only the complete amoral, valueless, un-American, traitorous initiates move forward to the head of the class. And they do so, of course, as we know, largely by bloodline, to keep it in the family. These aren't secrets anymore. This isn't a conspiracy anymore. We live in the modern age. All of this has been fully fleshed out, fully proven over and over and over again. The only thing left to debate is whether you like it and you're going to go with this, or you feel that this is the true definition of slavery and neo-slavery in this country and any country, and you want to stop it. Are you for it or against it? That's all it comes down to. I'm going to continue to play this clip, Eustace Mullins talking about the New World Order, and then we'll cover some basic materials and take your calls. Here is Eustace Mullins.
And so they were moneylenders, and they needed some way of advertising their business, and so the founder of this dynasty, the House of Rothschild, put up a red shield above his door so that people who came from various parts of Europe to change money with him could find it. And so after a few years, people didn't know who Bauer was, but they knew the Rothschild. The Red Shield was Rothschild. And so he simply began to call himself Rothschild.
He died eventually, but did he leave a dynasty of some sort? I mean, how did this happen?
Well, he left five sons who were very well trained by this man, who by that time had become the outstanding money lender of Europe due to a very peculiar circumstance. King George III and the Bank of England wanted to punish the American colonists for being so obstreperous and for refusing to give all of their profits to the Bank of England from their income. And so when they rebelled, then the British army did not really want to fight their American cousins. So King George said, well, I've got to get somebody else to fight this war. I need some mercenaries, some hired soldiers. And over in Germany, the Elector of Hesse, a German province, had a very well-trained group of soldiers called the Hessians. And so he said, well, I'll rent these out to you, King George, who was a German himself, by the way, a Hanover. And he said, for $5 million, you can have this nice army. And so George said, all right. And then when the Elector of Hesse got this $5 million, he said, what am I going to do with it? And they said, well, there's a very good investor and financial advisor named Meyer Amschel Rothschild there in Frankfurt. So he let Meyer Amschel lend out this money, which was the biggest chunk of capital in Europe at that time, $5 million. And so Amschel spread it around, and pretty soon he brought back $20 million to the Elector, who was very pleased, and kept $5 million for his efforts. So now he was a monetary power himself, and of course the Elector of Hesse let it be known that if you had money to invest, put it in Meyer Amschel's hands. So when Meyer died, he had five sons, and so they dispersed themselves over the five capitals of Europe, and Nathan went to London, James went to Paris, and so forth. So they now had total control of the monetary resources of Western civilization, the entire continent of Europe. And they had developed some very interesting techniques. One was that the courier went from James in Paris to Nathan, mayor in London, and he wanted $1 million in gold. So he would give him a note saying, I want $1 million in gold, but he would not sign it. So if someone came into a Rothschild office, a courier, and said, I have a request here for $1 million, it's signed James Rothschild, then Nathan knew it was fake because they didn't sign their communications.
A little trickery even then, but I think good little trickery.
Well, you live and learn, you know.
That's right. So we're talking about the New World Order. In the New World Order, we had the war with England, and that was the Revolutionary War. And there was the banking system that was set up, and that was Alexander Hamilton that set it up originally after that. Thomas Jefferson then went ahead and decided this was not good for the American people. And then after that, we had the War of 1812, and then we come to Andrew Jackson, and he fought the bankers again, and then we have the Rothschilds, and their dynasty is building. Tell us about the Rothschilds now, how they enter into the picture as far as, shall we say, the Federal Reserve is concerned.
Well, the Rothschilds realized early on you don't make any money by lending somebody $200 to buy a used car. They only dealt with governments and with the kings of Europe, and they only handled government loans because that's where the big money was. And you see, they realized it was a sure thing because if you lent money to a government and they didn't repay you, then they would never get any more money. And they always needed money for wars and for to build Versailles and so forth. To be a king means you spend a lot of money. You're a big spender. And they could always tax their people enough to repay the Rothschilds their money, so they had nothing to worry about. And so by 1880, the Rothschilds really owned all of Europe, and they owned a large part of the United States secretly, because they always advertised and promoted the idea that the Rothschilds had no activities in the United States. And they did not, because they worked through August Belmont, who was their named representative, and they also worked through J.P. Morgan and Kuhn Loeb Company, which were their secret representatives. And by 1896, these two Rothschild firms, J.P. Morgan and Kuhn Loeb, owned 96% of all the railroad mileage in the United States.
Wow, talk about a monopoly there.
And that's in congressional reports. I got that right out of most of my work, by the way, comes from congressional reports.
So you do researching on congressional reports, and how far do you back to this research information go, Eustace?
About 5,000 years.
5,000 years. We're talking to Eustace Mullins, ladies and gentlemen, and we're talking about the New World Order. Well, tell us then, the Rothschilds, tell us about the Federal Reserve. Now they've become involved in the Federal Reserve, and what about Soviet Russia? How did Soviet Russia come into this New World Order situation, Mr. Mullins?
Well, Soviet Russia was always part of the world order, and in fact, the Soviet Empire, the evil empire, which we heard so much about, and in the 1950s, we were digging atom bomb shelters in our backyards to protect us from this catastrophe, which was going to happen at any moment, and which was good for the contracting industry, but it didn't really help anybody as far as avoiding atomic bombs. So the Soviet Empire came about because of greed and envy. Now, communism, of course, is based on hatred, greed, and envy. But what people don't realize is that the Russian Revolution came about because of the greed and envy of King George V of England for his cousin, Tsar Nicholas II of Russia, who happened to be the richest man in the world. And when you're the richest man in the world, the consequence is all the people who are not quite as rich hate you and wish they could get their hands on your money. So the Rothschilds told King George V, they were all around him as his advisors in London. They said, look, let's go after Nick and get his dough. And George said, well, I'm game. And so the Rothschilds started the communist movement in Russia. And so they murdered the Tsar and his family and took his gold, which was sent to Paris and to Kuhn Loeb Company in New York and the other Rothschild offices, London and so forth. And some of this money, by the way, these Rothschild banks used to buy the original stock of the Federal Reserve System in 1914. That was all bought with the Tsar's money. And so the Romanov heirs, such as are still alive, are the real owners of our Federal Reserve System. And so, as I say, they murdered the richest man in the world, took all of his money.
Well, what year was that, by the way? What year was that when they murdered the Tsar?
Well, that was 1918. They had the communist revolution in 1917. And the first thing they did was go in and loot the whole country. They took all the money. And the result was the new Soviet empire had no operating capital. And they couldn't tax anybody because they had murdered all the people who owned anything. So you couldn't go out and tax the peasants to keep the country running. So they sent up cries of anguish, and people all over the world responded. Woodrow Wilson, our president, he made a speech to Congress in which he said, it is our duty to help these noble murderers in Moscow, in so many words. And so he first sent them $25 million of his personal war fund, voted to him by Congress to prosecute World War I. And he sent Elihu Root, who, by the way, wrote the charters of all the major foundations. Elihu Root was a lawyer of whom J.P. Morgan said, when I call in lawyers and I want something done, they give me a lot of reasons why it cannot be done. He said, when I call in Elihu Root says, what do you want me to do? And I tell him, and he does it. So that's why he became the lawyer for the big bankers in this country.
Now, tell me, Eustace, because there's a lot of people that have said that the banking themselves, that the communist revolution was started on Wall Street. Is that a true fact or not, Eustace Mullins?
We're going to get back to that and play part three of this. And no, you're not listening to a PBS NPR station. We are indeed AmericanFreedomRadio.com. I am Jack Blood, as always, here with you on Deadline Live, honoring the life, the work of the great Eustace Mullins, who left us yesterday at the age of 86 years old. First of all, I mean, looking at those two clips, one thing we do have to understand is that, you know, we fought a revolution against the king, as he said, not against the banks. The neo-revolution of which we find ourselves in today, against the neo-fascist like Obama and his mentors and his masters, the ultimate neo-revolution is against the banks. How about you say, this time, we get it right. Cut off the head and the body will die. Nations tied through the nose by Rothschilds and their agents means that war will always be a racket for these people. Thus, ending the Fed and detaching us from this world central bank system is the only way out. You remember listening, we played this on the program, the recent new puppet president of the European Union, Van Rompuy, as we call him, you can find this on the internet, announced the New World Order. This is 2009, the beginning of the New World Order. And that was, of course, due to the G20 agreements giving the IMF and World Banks more central powers than ever before. They used this recent, call it a depression, call it whatever you want. I call it an economic 9/11 being an inside job. They used that to finish their plan. If we do not stop them, we will never get back. We honor Eustace Mullins today. Please stay with us. Deadline Live, Jack Blood, AmericanFreedomRadio.com. joining us. America, the world. I don't know what we said about India. We checked in, our website was getting about 25% of its readers from India here just a couple of days ago. So welcome, India. That's all I'm going to say. Thanks for joining us in the program today. We are doing a tribute to Eustace Mullins. I dug up an old interview back from, I believe, the late 80s. And, you know, back when Eustace was still in pretty good form, the last, you know, 5 or 10 years, he got pretty old and pretty beaten up. It was very difficult to get him to be as prolific as I think he might be in this interview. He did one, I believe, as soon as just a few weeks ago. It was his last interview. I had to kind of let him go on his own. We didn't do many interviews with him recently. I had done quite a bit, though, about 4 or 5 years ago, and I really got to know him, really got to respect him, and respect my own responsibility to carry this mantle, to continue this work and this effort, to finally see the end of the Federal Reserve. And I only regret that Eustace Mullins and some of our great forefathers and originators in the anti-Federal Reserve movement didn't live to see the end of the Fed, which I think some of us are going to see. Of course, it is very important to have some kind of a plan to fill this vacuum. Otherwise, they'll do it for us. We have got the New World Order scared for the first time in a very long time. They understand that we see them now, that they're no longer invisible, that they can no longer walk through our lives and our homes and our bank accounts in the way that they used to do without any kind of scrutiny at all. Now things have changed. Now they're in the hot seat. Now it has become very popular to come out against the Federal Reserve. So that being said, you have to know who Eustace Mullins is. You have to read. If you get a chance, if you can find it, maybe you can go get it at BraveNewBookstore.com. The Secrets of the Federal Reserve, one of the great masterpieces by Eustace Mullins, as I mentioned earlier, inspired by the great poet Ezra Pound. I've got a couple of minutes left in this segment, so we're going to chip away at a little bit more of this. We'll play some in the second hour. And I'd love to take your calls, any reflections, any memories you have of Eustace Mullins, any comments you want to make on the Federal Reserve, and we'll cut in with a little bit of news here before we're all done the program. So those of you who tune in for news, we'll get what you pay for. Here it is again, Eustace Mullins talking about the New World Order. This is roughly about 20 years ago.
All the money for Wall Street, for the Bolshevik Revolution, came from Wall Street, really from Rothschild firms, but it would have been too obvious if the Rothschilds of London were sending all their money over to Russia to help the communists. So they did it through their favorite patsy, which is the American government. And they even formed a special firm on Wall Street in 1916 to finance the communist revolution in Russia, which was called American International Corporation. And its directors were Percy Rockefeller, the richest men in the United States, including a financier named George Herbert Walker, who just happened to be the grandfather of George Bush, our president.
Now, how does this George Bush fit in now? George Herbert Walker Bush, the former president, or about to be president of the United States, formerly anyway. How does he fit it with his father, and was it his father and the Rockefellers and the Harrimans and the Brown brothers? Did they all work together as far as this New World Order is concerned?
Well, the New World Order is a group of insiders. It's sort of an international mafia. And they either work together or they get eliminated. I mean, these people have to cooperate because the death sentence is automatic if you don't. And you don't say, I'm going my way, to heck with you, because if you go your way is straight down. And so George Bush was like a lot of scions of these World Order families. That is, he was unemployable. I mean, if he came in to be interviewed and there were eight people there, he would be the eighth one that you would hire if you had to hire eight people. And you know, Lyndon Johnson...
He should have had seven others when he was running for president of the United States.
It's too bad they didn't. Lyndon Johnson was quite a perceptive guy. He was a Texas redneck, and he came to Washington, and he looked at all these bright young men at the Central Intelligence Agency who were from the wealthiest families in the United States. They were there as a lark. They wanted to play James Bond, and their families would do... And as Lyndon said, he said, the CIA is composed of scions of wealthy families whose families would never dare let them near the business because it would be dissolved within 6 weeks. So George Herbert Bush, George Herbert Walker Bush, when he finished at Yale, and they said, well, should we put him in the family firm of Brown Brothers Harriman? They said, good God, no, we'll be in the breadlines within 2 months. So they said, let him go work. Let him do what everybody else does. Go work for Central Intelligence Agency and travel around and have fun. So George went to work for the CIA. It's the only job he ever had, just like Bill Buckley, another scion of a wealthy family. Bill Buckley was hired by the CIA when he finished at Yale, Skull and Bones. We're talking about the Brotherhood of Death here, the Skull and Bones crowd, which Bill Buckley and George Bush and all of the partners at Brown Brothers Harriman were members of this Illuminati fraternity established in 1848 as the Russell Trust by Daniel Court Gilman, who also, by the way, later set up the charitable foundations. Gilman was on the board of all of these so-called charitable foundations, which were simply secret instruments of the world order.
So George became a member of the CIA. Matter of fact, he was CIA director in 1976. An interesting thing happened to Eustace in 76, and that was when he met one Saddam Hussein, who became involved in power in Iraq at the time. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, George was always a business partner of Saddam, and he claimed he didn't know him, so he deliberately, when he was on camera, he always mispronounced his name. He always called him Sodom, as though he were trying to call him a sodomite. I don't know. But anyway, they've been business partners that goes way back. And Sodom himself, you know, is worth about $10 billion. He's a player on the world scene. And that's why when George was ranting about getting rid of the new Hitler, and he sent our army over there to do it, they walked away, leaving Saddam Hussein in total control.
All right, more of that. Pretty enlightening stuff, isn't it, folks? If you haven't heard any of this before, some of this is going to be very eye-opening to you, I guarantee you. I can back up everything that Eustace Mullins has been saying here in the first hour. We're going to do a little more of this in the second hour and hopefully take your calls, get to some news and information. I'm Jack Blood. This is Deadline Live, AmericanFreedomRadio.com. We'll be right back to start the second hour right after this.
Got one part Jack Daniels, two parts Gary Kool-Aid, and a trigger of formaldehyde from the jar with Hitler's brain in it, and we got smashed in the back. Is everybody in? Is everybody in? Is everybody in? The ceremony is about to begin.
Wake up! It's every underwear in the world! Has this dream stopped?
Illuminati! You've got to take control!
Your host, Jack Blood. Deadline Live is a daily wrap-up for those too busy in the daily grind to discern and dissect the news. While the so-called mainstream media buries the truth, Jack Blood uncovers it, exposing the lies that our trusted government officials do not want us to know. And now, please welcome Jack Blood.
Yes, we are locked in, loaded for the Propaganda War, second hour of Deadline Live coming your way. It is, Let me take a look at my calendar here. The third day of February 2010. I'm Jack Blood, your narrator, your tour guide, your radio gun reporting for the next hour. Sorry about the floating levels here, folk. Quiet, too loud, and now I'm hearing there's some static. We're going to get this right for you on the program today. Before we get back to a tribute, if you missed the first hour, we're doing a lengthy tribute today to anti-New World Orderist, researcher, documentarian, historian, a real historian, one Eustace Mullins, who passed away yesterday. And I could not let this show go by without doing an extensive tribute. You know, it caught me kind of off guard a little bit, so as much as I would have liked to have invited a whole bunch of people on to discuss the greatness of Eustace Mullins, father of the Anti-Federal Reserve Movement, I just didn't have time to pull that off today. Maybe we'll do something at another time. So we're going to go back to that here when we come back from this break. Let me just quickly remind you that our website is deadlinelive.info, deadlinelive.info. You can get your daily dose of news you're probably not supposed to know about, opinions, satire, music, everything you're looking for. Most likely at deadlinelive.info. We have a great opportunity for those who want to support the website and get some exposure for your business or your website. You'll see in the upper right-hand corner, there'll be a little box there. You simply use your PayPal, and we'll give you a scroller giving you some publicity for your business, your website, or shout-out to somebody that you want to promote right there at deadlinelive.info. A lot of people making that their home page now, working very hard. And we're launching a new all-info, all-original content website here, which we'll tell you about hopefully next week or as soon as we get done with that. Please support our sponsors both at AmericanFreedomRadio.com for this show, for deadlinelive.info, and most importantly, for the station you're listening to right now. However you're listening to this broadcast, most likely it is paid for by advertising. We're not going to be on here begging for money. The donations going to our website support the website, and you get something for it. So it's not begging, folks. But support our sponsors, the great Enterfood.com. I can tell you, we had some of the carrier monkey flu going around the blood compound. Knocked that thing right back. Never got a hold of us. None of us in our family, because we're all taking double doses of Enterfood. It is the supernatural, revolutionary, energy, green drink. 866-762-9238. You tell them I sent you. Get the trial bottle. Give it a try. You're going to love it. 50 cents a day. We'll come right back. Pick up with our tribute to Eustace Mullins right after this.
Welcome to the world's meeting place. American.
Practically narcotic.
Freedom.
Oh, yes. I like very much.
Radio.
You're an American institution.
American Freedom Radio.
Karma's gonna get you. Gonna knock you right in the head.
You better get yourself together.
Do you hear that, Bush crime family? Do you hear that, Obama, Cousin Barry? Instant karma's gonna get you. Thanks for joining us, folks. Deadline Live, I'm Jack Blood. Very sad that we lost Eustace Mullins yesterday, so I've taken the opportunity for my two-hour radio broadcast to dedicate the entire show to the words of Eustace Mullins. A lot of what you read in modern, let's call them, for the sake of argument, conspiracy books. I like to look at them as real history books sometimes. A lot of what we see in modern writing, in modern-day literature about the New World Order, comes from Eustace Mullins and people like Anthony Sutton. So we owe them a debt of gratitude. And we certainly are very honored, I would have to say, at least speaking for myself and my own humble opinion, to carry on this work. This is what drives me every day. And I hope that, you know, I look out there and I see this very inspirational group of young men and women today who are carrying this work, carrying the work that I myself have done for over 10 years. And it is, that's exactly what it's going to take. This is going to have to be multi-generational. And look how much we've accomplished thanks to people like Eustace Mullen. So rather than, you know, read from his book, The Secrets of the Federal Reserve, anybody can get that and just read it, rather than, you know, go on and proselytize and lecture you about how great Eustace Mullen is, I think the best thing to do would just to play him in his own words when he still completely had his faculties and could just run through this stuff like it was second nature. We left the clip, this again from a TV show broadcast, I believe, just before George Herbert Walker Bush was selected. You hear some of the references talking about Saddam Hussein, the first Gulf War, as we're leading up into that. They are at the point right now talking about who Saddam Hussein was, his connections to the Bush crime family. We'll continue with Eustace Mullins in his own words here on Deadline Live. Hope you enjoy it.
I don't think he ever heard a gunshot fired during that entire Iraqi war. But to get back to George, he didn't start out with the CIA. He started out as an agent, a secret agent of the CIA, who was running his own oil company called Zapata Oil Company. And, you know, George, when he wanted a name for his company, he wanted a name that really represented what he believed in. So he didn't call it the Thomas Jefferson Oil Company, and he didn't call it the George Washington Oil Company. He looked down at Mexico, where you had a communist revolutionary named General Emiliano Zapata. And Emiliano was quite a bloodthirsty guy. His idea of a good time was to go into a village and line up all the women and children and shoot them. So George said, this is my kind of guy. So he named his oil company Zapata Oil Company, which showed the kind of people that he would like to have around him. And the Zapata Oil Company was never anything but a front for the CIA. They did a lot of work in Mexico and in the Gulf of Mexico for the CIA. And, of course, when you had the supposed attack against Castro to wipe out communism in Cuba, George was in on the planning, and of course they bought two ships to haul freedom fighters to Cuba, and they named one of them Barbara after his wife, and they named the other ship Zapata after his oil company. So George was pretty well inside all the way, and of course they never intended to overthrow Castro. You see, when you set up a regime that you control, like in 1917, they set up the Bolshevik regime, and the American taxpayer supported the Soviet empire from 1917 right up till the time it collapsed. And the only reason it collapsed was that the United States was bankrupt. They couldn't send them any more money. So we destroyed communism by going bankrupt ourselves, which I guess is one way of doing it.
You said one time, Eustace, that the Russians have been trying to make it through the winter every winter since its inception of the communism, and we've been helping them through the winter.
Well, the guy who helped them first was Herbert Hoover. After they sent him money, Wilson sent him money, and then they said, we don't have any food. So Herbert Hoover, the great engineer who was a Rothschild employee, after he had been banned for life from the London Stock Exchange as a thief and an embezzler, and the Rothschild said, boy, we want this guy on our side.
Sure.
So they hired him as a director of Rio Tinto Zinc, one of their family firms. And in 1916, the Germans said, look, we can't fight any longer. We don't have any more money. We don't have any more food. And we don't have any more coal. So the Rothschilds said, well, hang on, and we'll see what we can do. So they got Herbert Hoover to inaugurate the German Relief Commission. But since we were at war with Germany, they couldn't well call it the German Relief Commission, so they called it the Belgian Relief Commission. And the Belgians were suddenly were astounded to find out that they were all starving when they had just had the best crop year they ever had. But anyway, the Belgian Relief Commission, which, by the way, was one of the greatest thieveries in the world, Herbert Hoover and his pals who ran this operation, they all came out of it multimillionaires. And Herbert Hoover, several times, remarked very sourly, some of these days, some prying SOB is going to want to look at our books. Well, no one ever did, and they kept their money. But after the Belgian Relief Commission, which kept the Germany in the World War One for two more years and brought a very satisfactory conclusion, then they called on Herbert to help them out again. They said, look, the Bolsheviks are starving. They've shot all the peasants and the farmers, and they have no food. So Herbert Hoover then organized Russian relief, and he went over and saved the Bolsheviks from total collapse. And somehow, after this, he became known as a great anti-communist, which just shows you what, when you control the media, you can sell any story that you want.
Absolutely. And one of the things that was so sad for me to read about, of course, was when the Bolsheviks did go into the Ukraine, and they did kill so many people. They starved between 6 and 8 million Ukrainians out. And this is the end result of what America has done, because America itself, this government, not the country, I don't believe the country, Eustace, I don't believe the patriotic people in the country, but this government was responsible for funding situations like this.
Great massacre of the Russian peasants in the early 1930s was deliberately suppressed by Walter Duranty, the chief correspondent in Russia of the New York Times, and he dictated what would be allowed to be sent back to this country. They totally suppressed this so that Franklin Roosevelt, as a principal plank of his platform in 1933, that was to give official diplomatic recognition to Soviet Russia so we could send them even more money of taxpayers' money than they'd been doing before. So, but they couldn't do this if the press was going to print a story that 10 to 12 million Russians had been murdered by Stalin. So the story was completely suppressed, and in fact, the American people today really don't know whether to believe it or not. There have been several books out about it by Robert Conquest, which are very good, totally documented, but they don't get much play in the media.
Mm-hmm. You know, they had a movie at one time on PBS, but PBS refused to run it in most of its affiliate, and that was Harvest of Despair.
Oh, yes.
It was a television, I think it was about an hour and a half long, or a couple hours anyway, but it showed exactly what happened and the terrible human tragedy that this government, the United States of America government, was involved in by the fact that they supported communism in other parts of the world, namely the Soviet Union at that time. You know, it's interesting to me, Eustace, that over 70 million people have been killed by communism, many by their own people, and we still support governments like that. How can this happen, Eustace Mullins?
Well, you mentioned public broadcasting system, PBS, which to most people in the know, they call it the phony. They say PBS stands for the phony broadcasting system because they're a bunch of goofy left-wingers and homosexuals, and they're so relentlessly far left in their orientation that occasionally some congressman or some senator will point out, has PBS ever published any or run anything which was of a conservative nature? And, of course, the answer is no. And whenever someone in Washington points this out, why they would have to point it out, I don't know, because all you got to do is turn this phony broadcasting system on, and you can see it for yourself. But whenever a congressman mentions this, they immediately denounce him in the entire press as a hate monger, guy who wants to suppress freedom of speech. Mm-hmm. And, of course, there is no freedom of speech on the phony broadcasting system because it's totally left-wing.
Now, we have a number of people, different types of people, different nationalities in this world. We had World War One, we had World War Two, we had South Korean War, and then we had Vietnam. Should we have fought any of those wars, Eustace Mullins? Was there a real reason? And what was the end result of us being involved in, say, World War One and World War Two?
Well, John, you have to understand what wars are. Wars are carefully staged productions. Now, these are all carefully staged, and they did what they were supposed to do, and they had a good audience, and so I think they were successful. But to say that these wars were about anything, that they had some particular philosophy of government opposing another philosophy of government, is total nonsense. These were world order productions, and as I say, they were carefully staged. Both sides were set up to perform in a certain manner, and the outcome was always predetermined. In other words, you were looking at a staged production which you had already seen many times, a sort of a soap opera, and you knew how it was going to come out before it even started.
Now, Eustace, you're a veteran, and I'm a veteran. And I know when I went in the service, I was just about as patriotic as anybody could possibly be. That's the way that I felt anyway. And, you know, I saw things in the service, Eustace Mullins, that would lead me to believe that I still love my country, don't get me wrong, but it's this government that I don't think that I'd ever fight for again, because you just kill a lot of people, raise a lot of debt, raise a lot of taxes. I come back, the people are far worse off than they ever were before, and we seem to be enslaving ourselves. Is this true, or am I imagining things?
Oh, you're not imagining anything. In fact, I was in the Air Force during World War II, and I can't say that we were very patriotic, because during our basic training down here at Miami Beach, we were marching along, drilling in the morning, and we were singing to cadence, and we would sing, I hate wall. Eleanor hates wall. My dog, Walla, hates wall. And all we did was make fun of these phonies in Washington, you see. So I can't say that we were that patriotic. And over in England, whenever Winston Churchill came on, Evelyn Waugh, one of the most famous English novelists, pointed out in his memoirs that whenever Winston Churchill came on the radio while they were sitting around in their officers' club with one of his great speeches, they would sit around, they would laugh themselves to tears at this old drunk, you see. So, whether apparently he didn't inherit the taint, but anyway, he was always a little goofy, and he was really a drunk. If he didn't have his two quarts of whiskey a day, he really didn't know where he was. And during the great Blitz of London, most people thought he was, you know, being very brave, staying in London during the Blitzkrieg.
Oh, that's where his two quarts of whiskey were.
Well, he was 8 stories down. They built him a special shelter, 8 stories down in the ground, a very comfortable room, and he was liberally supplied with whiskey. And in fact, they used to show this room, a historian named David Irving did a new biography of Winston Churchill, and he was an establishment historian. He was published by Macmillan, which is owned by the Rothschilds, and so he sent this new biography of Churchill to the offices of Macmillan, in which he went in at some length about how this old drunk slept out the war in this special room underneath London. And they said, oh no, you can't print that. And he said, well, that's the key to my whole biography. And so they said, well, goodbye. And they refused to print the book. And he finally got it out on his own. And he started touring and lecturing on some of his discoveries, with the result that Canada officially banned him from entering Canada as a very dangerous person, because he was telling the truth about Winston Churchill. And they have riots when he speaks, you know, and it's all very exciting.
We're talking with Eustace Mullins today, ladies and gentlemen, and this is the book. It's The World Order and it's about our secret rulers. It's extremely, extremely important that we understand what is happening in America today, because we do have a $4 trillion debt. The nation is on its way down. We've become a third world entity, and we used to be the finest, the strongest, the most industrialized, the number one nation in the world. And our education system also used to be the very best. We're having severe problems, ladies and gentlemen, and that's why Bobby Lee is here today with Eustace Mullins, one of the patriots and the heroes of the truth and the Jeffersonian philosophy of government. So this is the book that I think that you must have in your possession in order to become educated about the world order. The business of America, what really, when we're talking about the business of America, what is the business of America? I thought it was for little businesses to be able to start and to work hard and to progress, and for a small family to be able to build themselves up and become financially successful and with morals and ethics, and everybody work for the common good. Is that the way that business is done in the government today?
No, that's the myth. But we, unfortunately, you and I are talking here today about the reality. we could talk about myths all evening if we wished, but if we're going to talk about reality, then we have to say that this is a soap opera from Hollywood, The American Dream. What we are facing today is the American nightmare, a wholly owned colony dictated to by aliens, in which the chance of a young person today of making it is almost nil, unless he happens to be a scion of one of the insider world order dynastic families, as George Bush was. Now, George Bush, of course, his path was smooth. He was a member of the Brotherhood of Death from Yale University. And we were so lucky to have him replaced by Bill Clinton, apparently from Middle America, the heartland of America, a Rockefeller protege, a Rhodes Scholar. There's never been a Rhodes Scholar. They're the Rothschild Scholars, but they didn't want to call themselves Rothschild Scholars, so they named themselves Rhodes Scholars. So we have now in Washington Bill Clinton, a Rothschild Scholar and Rockefeller protege. You know, the Washington Post on June 21st explained the sudden meteoric rise of Bill Clinton when you had all these people contending for the presidential nomination in the Democratic Party, and they all looked equally qualified, they all looked equally stupid, and which would satisfy the American
people.
And they were all lawyers, and they were all protégés and insiders. You had Albert Gore, whose family...
All right, we'll pick up on that, and also I want to make some comments. This joke Obama is passing around, that this new ruling by the Supreme Court is someone going to allow foreign money to buy U.S. candidates. When you listen to this, you see the bigger picture, don't you? We'll be right back after this, our tribute to Eustace Mullins. Stay tuned.
Can you handle the truth? Tune into the Truth Brigade with Christy Chikowski weeknights from 7 to 9 p.m. Central, only on American Freedom Radio.
Very important to be yourselves, to live up to your potential, and not just to be an extension of some kind of matrix programming going on out there. It's Super Bowl week. I like me some bread and circus. I like me some gladiatorial games, a good distraction. But Mark Dice, who's just done a video, the Super Bowl has been canceled, makes some pretty good points. I mean, people know more statistics about our sports heroes, our gladiators, than they do about the things you heard about on the program today. As much as I'd like to, you know, be entertaining and funny for you, I'm sure we probably lost a lot of listeners due to the kind of dry nature of some of the information. I felt, you know, really in my heart that this was an important show to do, and I'm lucky that I found this old interview with Eustace Mullins, who passed away yesterday at the age of 86 years old, just a great American and a great historian. And if I ever sit and think, well, gee, you know, I should be more popular for what I do, certainly. Some of you have been following my career for 15 years, you'll realize that, and I've done just about everything I can to ruin that. Shows you where I'm coming from. And then I look at this amazing documentary, this video, this interview, this classic, just once-in-a-lifetime interview that we've been playing for you today, and it's got 400 views on YouTube. So sometimes, you know, I mean, then you go and you look at Beyonce or something, who, by the way, just strolled out with a bunch of militarized police backing her, background singers, stormtroopers at the recent Grammy Awards ceremony. It is certainly a ceremony. And she'll have millions and millions and millions of hits. So it's just that there's no accounting for the tastes of Americans or for people around the world, for that matter. And I ask you, you know, who do you believe? You've heard most of go through this information by Eustace Mullins, most of the program. Who do you believe? Do you believe Eustace Mullins? Do you believe Smedley Butler, one of the most highly decorated Marines in history, who stopped a Wall Street coup by the DuPonts and the Morgans, Rothschild agents, on our White House, on our president? All of that, largely, I'm sure, a psyop. But still, he did that. War is a racket, and he would know. Or maybe Anthony Sutton, would you believe him? Or even something more contemporary, like the work of, I'll bring him up, David Icke. one of the greatest books I've ever read, and The Truth Shall Set You Free, which covers a lot of the information you're hearing here that have been circulating now for decades. Or even more contemporary, Stephen Kinzer, who's been on this program, who really broke the big story about Operation Ajax starting in the 50s, the first CIA coup on Mohammad Mossadegh, a democratically elected leader in Iran. And of course, we see everything that's happened since today. Iran playing chicken with the West. All of that goes right back to everything you're hearing Eustace Mullins talk about. So who would you believe? Would you believe him, Smedley Butler, Tony Sutton, Stephen Kinzer? Or would you believe the history books published by Carnegie Mellon Rockefeller Institutes? That created these school books, this curriculum, No Child Left Behind, the United Nation, admitted by Chris Dodd's dad, Senator Dodd's father, before his death, to G. Edward Griffin. That's on YouTube. You can just see him admit how they've altered history for their own benefit. It is all an illusion. So who would you believe? Any of what you're hearing on the program today can be easily checked out. Thankfully, now we have these information resources to do that. I beg of you to take very seriously what you're hearing on the program today. I want to go back to it. Again, this is our memoriam, our tribute to Eustace Mullins, and here he is again from just about 20 years ago talking about the New World Order. He was discussing the Rhodes Scholar or Rothschild Scholar, Cecil Rhodes, starting the Round Tables that became the Royal Institute of International Affairs, became the Council on Foreign Relations, the Club of Rome, and all the rest. These are Fabian socialists, the modern term of redistributing wealth from the bottom to the top, something your own cousin Barry Obama is doing today, even as we broadcast this show around the world. Eustace Mullins talking about the New World Order. We'll pick up where we left off. Here it is.
In the Democratic Party, and they all looked equally qualified. They all looked equally stupid, and which would satisfy the American people.
And they were all lawyers.
And they were all lawyers, and they were all protégés and insiders. You had Albert Gore, whose family has lived off of largesse from Arm & Hammer for many years, the founder of the Communist Party of the United States, and this has all been printed in the Washington Post and many other places. So suddenly the Rockefellers said, well, it's time for the show to be over, and so Senator Jay Rockefeller and David Rockefeller notified them, Clinton is the man, I want all you other people to disappear. And so Clinton came forth as number one Rockefeller choice.
You know, it's amazing. Of course, you know, to me, from changing from George Herbert Walker Bush to Bill Clinton is just like leaving the soiled diaper on the baby and just changing the safety pin.
Well, very good analysis.
Right. But it was money bought and paid for, as you know, and Jackson Stevens loaned Bill Clinton $2 million, and that was back in, I believe, around February. So, and Bill Clinton was really kind of almost getting down towards the bottom of the heap of those seven individuals that first had decided to run for President of the United States on a Democratic ticket. And all of a sudden he had this money. He came into Georgia, had 26 people that he employed as far as being front people. And pretty soon he took Georgia in the South, and he was well on his way. And I think that was pretty close to it. But he was a bought and paid for, you're saying. You're saying that Bill Clinton himself is bought and paid for, and are you telling me that we voted for a change and the change isn't going to come to our benefit, Eustace?
Yeah, hold on. Does that sound familiar, folks? And I'm looking at some of the hairstyles here and trying to date this because there is no appropriate date signature on the video we're playing. So you can see it came a little bit later than we initially had thought. But remember that? Some of you are old enough to now at this point, and I'm showing my age. Bill Clinton playing the sax was going to bring us change and hope.
That reminds me of a story I heard in my small town in Virginia. And these two businessmen were talking, and one of them had a bill that he wanted to be approved in Congress. And he said, I wonder if I couldn't influence Congressman so-and-so in Washington to vote for this bill if I, just bought him. And the other man said, Don't be ridiculous. That's the most insulting thing I ever heard of. He said, Congressman so-and-so was bought and paid for long before he ever got to Washington.
and that's an honest congressman. Once he's bought and paid for, you know, he stays bought and paid for,
absolutely.
I guess.
He goes off the block. He's no longer available.
Right. We're coming to today, and we're coming from George Bush to Bill Clinton. What do you see in the future for America for the next 10 years, Mr. Smoltz? This new world order, is it taking shape, or do you think that all of a sudden we're going to come to critical mass and it's all going to disintegrate before our very eyes?
Well, I think we're at critical mass already. Now, we have a very interesting situation, which we saw during the last election. You had the biggest turnout that you ever had, and of course, the trend had been for lower and lower percentages of the American people to come out and vote, because they did everything that they possibly could to discourage the American people from participating in the election. Fewer people voted every year because, you know, they made sure they understood you either vote for Tweedledum or Tweedledee, and it doesn't make any difference which one gets in, because we created them both out of nothing, just like the Federal Reserve creates money out of nothing, and we create these politicians out of nothing. And when you look at them, you can see that they come from nothing.
There's
no question.
Absolutely nothing.
There's no question about that in anyone's mind. Well, this time, you suddenly had a wild card, and that was a billionaire named Perot. He appeared on the scene, and he was almost elected president by acclamation. People were so disgusted with these phonies, Bush and Clinton, and no matter how hard you tried, you couldn't say anything good about either one of them. And so the people looked, and here's a successful businessman, Perot, spunky, got down to business. He would get on television and rivet the attention of the American audience simply with a few charts, which has always been a no-no in politics. You never show a chart to the people if you want to get votes.
Well, you never tell them how it's really like.
That's right. And you never tell them, look, we're destitute, we've got to start thinking of something. Because, you see, the Rothschilds and the World Order dynastic families, they profit by other people's suffering and despair. They profit when you have a communist revolution go in and murder 10 million peasants. And so, this is exactly what happens. You know, Baron Alphonse de Rothschild was asked during the communist revolution there, he said, aren't you worried about all of your houses and your vast estates and so forth with the revolution going on? He said, certainly not. He said, you always want to buy when blood is running in the streets. That is, when everybody thinks we're collapsing, nothing's going to be worth anything, and they say, I'm going to dump this for a penny on the dollar. That's when the Rothschilds and the insiders buy everything. And, of course, the United States is coming to that point now. We're in a recession. Real estate is down. This is the time to buy, because this is a fluctuating thing. It goes up and it comes down. It goes up and it comes down, because it's manipulated. It's always manipulated. You know, J.P. Morgan was asked once, as the leading banker in the United States, someone rushed up to him and said, Mr. Morgan, please, would you tell me, what is the stock market going to do? He said, sir, it will fluctuate.
I love it. That's a great story. Let's go back to the dynasties, because one time I heard you speaking, Eustace, and you said that there are three tiers as far as the dynasty of families is concerned, from the Rothschilds and the New World Order. Could you explain that three-tier system to me?
Well, nothing can really function unless there's a hierarchy. Somebody at the top has to tell the people lower down what to do and how to think and how to act and so forth. So in the World Order, you have a very distinct hierarchy. Dynastic families who can trace their lineage back thousands of years. And because they have learned to survive and how to manipulate other people to do their will. And that's all being a member of the World Order means. You know how to use other people and profit by them. And whether you slaughter them or rob them or torture them, whatever you do, you make money at it. And this is what they do. So in the World Order, you have a top hierarchy of first-tier rank of dynastic families, composed really of the old surviving aristocracies of Europe. The black nobility, they're called. They're called the black nobility because they came from the darker strain in the aristocracy of Europe. And the old Viking, blue-eyed, blonde aristocrats, more or less, were pushed into the background, or they intermarried with the black nobility and became contaminated. And this is what you have. Of course, the surviving royal family in Europe today is the royal family of England, and they have been black nobility since the 12th century when the Este family of Italy married into the British royal family. So the first rank, first tier, is the old aristocracies of Europe plus what they call their Hofjuden, which are the Rothschilds and families of that nature, who are able to raise money for them and keep them functioning. Now, in the second tier of world dynastic families, the world order, you have the families who themselves are enormously rich and powerful, but their duty is to serve as courtiers to the first tier of dynastic families. And people in that category are the Rockefellers, the Harrimans, the Morgans, and so forth. Now you have a third tier of dynastic families who serve the second tier. They're never allowed to approach the real top people in the first tier, but they can only serve through serving the second tier. And these are families like George Herbert Walker Bush family. George Herbert Walker was president of W.A. Harriman Company, and the Bush family's entire career in banking was to serve the Harriman interests, who in turn served the Rothschilds. So that's why I began to use the term about Bush as a dynastic family in the world order of the third tier. And it was picked up, and I see it popping up everywhere. They say George Bush is a third tier family. They don't even know what they're talking about. They don't explain it because they don't know how to explain it, but that's at least it. Much of my material, by the way, Bob, I see popping up all over the place because it goes into the system and is sort of piped in and begins to be picked up by people. For instance, columnists like Pat Buchanan and James Kilpatrick. Every once in a while, they'll pick up something of mine. Pat Buchanan had a column not long ago in which he denounced the Trotskyite wing, the neoconservatives of the Republican Party, which I had been speaking about publicly for about 5 years. And so.
All right, we'll play the final segment here. Sorry, no breaking news today. Go find that at deadlinelive.info or your favorite website. We'll be back tomorrow with all of that. I want to clean this up and finish this up, our tribute to Eustace Mullins today, who left this world for a better place just yesterday. Deadline Live, I'm Jack Blood. Please stay with us.
Your head and you ask, is this where it is? Then somebody points to you and says, it's his. And you say, what's mine? And somebody else says, well, what is? And you say, oh my God, am I here all alone? But something is happening and you don't know what it is.
Yeah, we don't steal other people's work here on our broadcast. We give everybody, whether it be the radio show or the website, we give everybody credit for the work that they do. And it all seems to go back, if you follow the lineage of the people out there, all these decades fighting the New World Order, it all seems to go back to this one guy, Eustace Mullins. He, as I mentioned, left us yesterday. Long life, 86 years old, most of it spent fighting central banks and the New World Order and exposing the real history of this world. And if we don't understand this, it doesn't matter how many 9/11 inside jobs you expose, they will keep doing it. We've got to. We have got to cut the tether. We've got to set this thing right, folks. We have been given so many great opportunities here in the modern era, this neo-revolution. Can we now put aside our differences and can we now join together to finish the job? We see them. We've got our hands in the put your hands together like this, folks, like you're strangling somebody. Do it with me. We've got them. We're approaching them. And we're ready to wring their ugly, stinking New World Order necks. Okay, metaphorically, just for any Secret Service or FBI or whoever might be listening, we want to make sure to clarify that. So I honor this man today who has taught me so much that I could pass that along to you so you can pass that along to other people so that they can pass it along and so that the tree of liberty can be watered and bear fruit. Here is the final few minutes of this. And by the way, this entire video linked up at our website, deadlinelive.info, under RIP Eustace Mullins. Rest in peace, Eustace Mullins. You'll find the first one, and you can find the entire thing. Send this out to everybody. Let's remember this man who was so forgotten in the final years of his life. Just stupendous, all in all. But here's the final piece. Enjoy it.
And which I describe in my book of The Rape of Justice. I give you the whole story about that takeover. And as I say, it's rather flattering to see these things come out in public piecemeal. Mm-hmm. They never really explain it, and of course they never attribute it to my writings, but at least it's getting around, and that's helpful.
Now, we've had this last election, of course. H. Ross Perot did an excellent job, a wonderful job. He only collected 20%, though, because of the fact I think a lot of people in the media themselves always kept saying, well, a third party can't win. And yet we've had a two-party system in this country, but some people say it's just one party. It's the Democrat wing of the Communist Party or the Republican wing of the Communist Party. Could you explain that? Could that be true at all?
Well, it's been true since 1933. You see, you had a man in a wheelchair running for governor of New York named Franklin D. Roosevelt, Delano Roosevelt, and he was the grandson of the most successful opium dealer in Hong Kong named Warren Delano. And, you know, the myth about the great fortunes of this country is that these were hardworking people who saved their money and built important businesses. The fact is, most of the old family money in this country came from dealing in drugs and dealing in slaves, the slave trade and the world opium trade. Mm-hmm. And, of course, the Roosevelt, the Delano Roosevelts.
We've become the slaves now. dealing in slaves.
Well, what has happened in this country and over the world is we have reverted to the world order. We have reverted to the Middle Ages. We have a feudal system now in which you might say futile system because of the way it works. But it's a feudal system in which you have the serfs and you have the lords in the castle, and that's it. And there's not to be anything in between. You see, the great achievement of Western culture, of European culture, was to produce, to move from the Middle Ages into modern times by producing a middle class, a hard-working, thrifty, sober group of people who created businesses and went into production, and they built homes and businesses and so forth, and they brought prosperity. But you see, when you're very rich, you don't like to see prosperity. I mean, what's the good of having money when everybody else has money, you see? So the world order, they want to see everybody poor.
Then they can control them, is that it?
They can control them, and also it's much more satisfying to have a castle and a yacht if you know that all the peasants down there will never have these things
yeah.
and compete with you, you see.
So that's the basis of the meaning of it ain't all relative. Food is a weapon. The economy is a weapon. The drugs are a weapon. Water is a weapon. They're weaponizing space. They're weaponizing cyberspace. They're weaponizing the skies. They have taken control of absolutely everything. And finally, now, the peasants are fighting back. And that's why, of course, they want to get rid of your guns. That's why the story we had for you today that we didn't get to, the IRS is stocking up on shotguns. They were about to call you out. They were about to increase. Yesterday we talked about taxes. They are going to increase taking from you by the way of the gun, by the way of extortion, blackmail, and every other device that they have available to them to make your life even more miserable. They're moving ahead. What are you doing? I can't think of anything more important than the subjects covered by Eustace Mullins, flashback from 15 years ago, I guess, today, and getting that information out. That information becomes second nature, common knowledge to all of the the serfs in fiefdom out there. The new kings are the same families who have given some kind of authority over you, over your freedom in the modern era. How can this survive? Hey, thankfully, we had people like Eustace Mullins to show us the way. Now it's up to us. What will you do? What will you do, America? It's time to get up. Get out your window. Shout as loud as you can. Make all your neighbors hear you, everyone in the cubicle. I'm mad as hell, and I'm not going to take it anymore! Trite. But it never gets old. Thank you for joining us. We'll be back tomorrow with more news and information you're not supposed to know about. Until then, stay bold, America, and mighty forces will come to your aid.